Welcome to the Psych Experience.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Psych Experience, the podcast for those who love psychology and psychiatry. Dr. Nadi, in a previous chat, we covered limitations of our diagnostic resources, low inter-rater reliability, meaning the difficulty in having two providers agree with a given diagnosis. I wanted you to elaborate more on those and provide some examples, if you will.
All right, so let's start. Okay, so we could start talking about the overlap between diagnoses. We could choose like two common ones and go from there. So let's, for example, if you take major depressive disorder, right? Basically, we need depressed mood or inability to enjoy stuff, what we call anhedonia, technically, plus enough of the following things to complete a total of five symptoms, including this. So weight loss or gain or decrease or increase in appetite, that all counts as one. You can have, you know, if you have increase in appetite and increase in and you gain weight, so that's still one criteria. And obviously, you cannot have weight loss and weight gain at the same time. Right. Insomnia or hypersomnia, and we have a lot of these dichotomous criteria in depression. You can insomnia or hypersomnia, like you can't sleep or you can't stay awake, pretty much. Psychomotor agitation or retardation, fatigue or loss of energy, feeling worthlessness or guilt, impaired attention, thoughts of that. There's also indecisiveness thrown over there at some point. Mm-hmm. Now, as a piece of psych trivia, if you take all the diagnostic criteria of major depressive disorder and you do, I forgot what's the mathematical term, but I had a chance of doing that with someone I know that is a math teacher, and you can have potential more than 800 different combinations of the depressive disorder, which is all treated as
more than 800. Wait, you said 800?
800. Yeah, 800. Yeah, because the way you do this calculation is, and it's, I reviewed it, it's true. I explained the whole criteria to a mathematician and he came back with that to me. So for me, so it, like, wow. You can have like depressed mood plus 4, or depressed mood and anhedonia plus 3, or you can have anhedonia plus 4, mm-hmm. and then you can change, you can have high, more appetite or less appetite, you can have insomnia or hypersomnia, and you play with that, you can have more than 800 different combinations. It's kind of useless information. It gives you a sense of how, you know, and I think what that insight brings is that we're still looking for biological markers, mm-hmm. of disorders of a machine or an organ that is designed to transform itself. So really, it's going to be a tough one, you know. And so far, the yield of genetic testing has been, and it's needed. I'm not saying we shouldn't be looking for, mm-hmm. We should be looking for, but we still don't know how the brain works, and probably we don't know how the DNA works either. But let's not go there. Now let's talk about some of these criteria. So psychomotor agitation, that is part of major depressive disorder criteria, could also be understood or described or be a synonym for restlessness, which is a generalized anxiety disorder criteria.
Yeah.
The fatigue or loss of energy of major depressive disorder equals being easily fatigued from the generalized anxiety disorder. The impaired attention is the same pretty much as difficulty concentrating, right? One is from MDD, the other one from JD. Right. And finally, insomnia equals sleep disturbance, right? Insomnia of major depressive disorder is not that different from sleep disturbance of generalized anxiety disorder. Now, generalized anxiety disorder needs three symptoms plus excessive anxiety, whatever that means for the diagnosis. So it's like an anxious fella, mm-hmm. someone who has generalized anxiety disorder, who lost his girlfriend, and now he's sad, all of a sudden also meets criteria for major depressive disorder. And the same is true if you're depressed and absolutely indifferent to life, but you receive an eviction notice, you know, and you do that for about 2 weeks, now you have generalized anxiety disorder as well.
Now, how do you tell the difference? Or at least, how would someone know how to tell the difference?
Well, there are a few distinctive factors that would allow a more informed interview to figure the difference. And also, you know, to figure if you have anxiety as a separate entity from major depressive disorder, considering that the diagnosis of major depressive disorder actually has a modifier called with anxious features. Or no, with anxious distress, I think is the right wording, which pretty much covers the comorbid presence of anxiety in major depressive disorder. Mm-hmm. And that is quite common, but puts the provider at a task to find out if the anxiety is part of the depressive disorder, the depressive syndrome, or if he has a life of its own.
Are there ways to know it?
There are hints, clues, you know, like time relations and also studying phenomenology beyond the DSM can help you, have a sort of a better, clear picture of it. Because at the end of the day, we got to remember psychiatry is an art. We base our thoughts and decisions in a few principles. I think largely data, but, we have those confounders, as we spoke before, like the oral tradition and stuff like that. But also, we should be basing a lot of what we do on, hopefully we will be basing a lot of what we do on philosophical and ethical principles.
Does it matter considering that treatment of GAD and MDD also have a lot of overlap?
Freaking good point. For the most part, by missing the difference between these two things, you will not hurt a lot of patients because, if you're practicing fairly safely and take into account guidelines and, some of the prescribing principles we have discussed before, you'd start with an antidepressant, an SSRI, and, you'd progress as you, if your treatment fails, which happens a lot. But then things get more, and as it does, as you fail and you progress, things get a little bit more complicated. But for the most part, there's no major damage. There are a few antidepressants that are, they're more activating, mm-hmm. Or they can actually worsen anxiety in that sense. So you may want to do things in a way that is safe on both ways because of that. But I see your point. For the most part, nobody's going to be terribly hurt by that difficulty.
So the damage is not that harsh. Are there other examples where this overlap of symptoms has more impact?
Oh yeah. So. We spoke about before substance induced psychiatric disorders and actual psychiatric disorders. And one example that I had a presentation and I have as one of the classes of the one of the it's a part of a module in the mentorship is the overlap between ADHD and generalized anxiety disorder. Actually, I spoke to a colleague a few days and he asked me to put one together about PTSD and ADHD, but mm-hmm. that's not ready yet.
So can you develop a little bit more on those two?
Perfect. So if you remember, I think we spoke about the concept of function, right? So if you throw a rock or if you throw a piece of wood at an attacker, mm-hmm. even though the form is different, or if you punch the attacker, what you're doing is different. From a shape or topography perspective, but functionally you're doing the same thing. You're trying to hurt or stop your attacker, mm-hmm. right? If you do, this is the my favorite example. You're going out with your girlfriend and she's wearing a super short dress, and you say, "There's no way you're going out with that dress." But instead of doing that, you're got a smarter guy, and you look at her and say, "Honey, I think it's a little bit cold." And in both of the things, she ends up with long pants. Then, what you did was those two things are functionally equivalent.
Right.
Now, we have some functional equivalence of behaviors that are automatically or intrinsically, I should say, reinforced. For example, and I gave that example before, like we believe that in OCD, when you have a rumination, like, "Oh my God, did I check the door? Did I check the door? Did I check the door? Did I check the door?" And you go and you check the door, and now you experience relief. So that experience, the relief will be the reinforcer of the obsession, mm-hmm. and that kind of perpetuates the problem. So when we look into taking that into account, and those concepts are widespread and accepted in psychology for the most part, when you take a look into ADHD and generalized anxiety disorder, you're going to find a huge functional overlap to the point that, I could make a claim that the diagnosis of ADHD based on the criteria, I'm not saying they're necessarily the same thing. Mm-hmm. I'm saying the criteria is limited, which is not a criticism to the criteria. It's not a, angry criticism to the criteria. We have the SMs, the best we managed to come together so far, but that doesn't mean that, you know, when you love something, you want that thing to improve. So there you have it. So, for example, let me read a few stuff about, let me find here, just a second. All right, so if we look into ADHD criteria, right? We have inattention, and then they say six or more of the following symptoms need to be present. And I'm going to read some of them that are quite typical of bad anxiety. Often fails to, it's subtle.
It's subtle.
Often fails to close to give close attention to details, makes careless mistakes. All right. So anxiety, as we know, you know, it's related to activation and flight or fight response, adrenaline. And what all those, all that physiological response does is to improve your ability to see the big picture. There's even a pupillary dilation associated with anxiety because pupillary constriction allows you to look to details, to focus. And anxiety is, and fear, they're designed to make you able to find escape route. So you need a vision of the big picture. So giving attention to details when you're anxious, and anyone listening to this right now is going to be, yes, you know, shaking their head, nodding their head, I should say, saying, yes, it's true. It's
yeah,
true.
I'm doing it right now. So shaking my head, and yeah, this makes sense.
Good. I thought, okay, that's good. So, and then the next criteria is pretty much the same. Has difficulty sustaining attention. It's the freaking same thing. And then you go to, but what the important thing is that while generalized anxiety disorder said difficulty concentrating, the diagnosis of ADHD, which is quite brilliant because it's something that is has a lot of the focus of attention is childhood, you may not have the same degree of expression or verbal expression or expressiveness on a kid. So the diagnostic criteria involves a bunch of observable behaviors, right? Or more observable in that sense, but difficulty sustaining attention. The next one will be often does not follow through on instruction and fails to finish schoolwork. Now, failing to finish things could be a result of inattention, but also restlessness, but we'll get there. Then there's another two that I selected. Often easily distracted by extraneous stimuli, which is the same damn thing, is often forgetful in daily activities. Yeah, if you can focus on something, there's no registration. If you can register, there's no memory of that, right? And all of that are, all of those are pretty much functional equivalent to impaired focus, inattention, right? Which is a symptom of generalized anxiety disorder. Now let's go for hyperactivity, impulsivity, or restlessness, you know. So often fidgets with or taps hands or feet or squirms in seat. Anxious people fidget, right? Come on, like it is, we don't need to be a researcher to know that.
Yeah.
Leaves the seat in situations where remaining seated is expected. Anxiety does that to you, causes restlessness. You know, you just have a hard time sitting when you're waiting for something that is making you anxious. I mean, you may be waiting for someone to text you back. You're going to be walking up and down and, you know, one side to the next. It's unable to play or engage in leisure activities quietly. Like, try to picture this as a Friday. You get an email from your boss saying, we need to talk Monday.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, and you have a barbecue with the family of her girlfriend for Saturday scheduled.
Right.
I'm not going to be freaking present.
Mm-hmm.
Often blurts out an answer before a question has been completed. I don't think I have to argue that anxiety does that to you too. And often interrupts or intrudes on others, which is, you know, can't wait your turn kind of thing, which is kind of all. So those are all observable things that will. So in that sense, generalized anxiety disorder, a very anxious kid would meet criteria for ADHD. We also see that a lot with PTSD. But and what's going to be the topic of another conversation is the fact that when kids get the diagnosis of ADHD, they usually don't have the enough agency to say, by the way, uncle touched me funny last month. And then he starts having behavioral problems. He's not present. He's anxious. He's angry. You know, we don't see those things. The kid's not going to look, no, doc, don't worry. I don't have ADHD. Daddy has been doing funny things to me at night. You know, you're not going to see that freaking thing. You're going to see that when you are an adult. Now, I have one of the sites where I work. I have this. I don't want to go there. That's a whole nother conversation. We're going to go there another day.
Okay. let's get back to the tracks here. So now the damage is evident considering the different treatments.
Yes. And you know, in psychiatry, we cannot take a response to treatment as a proof of a correct diagnosis. You know, not on this field. Maybe other parts of the medicine, all good. But in psychiatry, it's not impossible, for example, that just by boosting a bit of your attention, you'd feel less anxious. Like, let's assume I'm giving stimulants to a kid who's anxious, right? It's not impossible that he's going to say, I am less anxious now, because if you improve your attention, let's say you're overwhelmed. Let's say you have a tough job. And the tough job pulls you in different directions. Now, you know you have 3 or 4 tasks to perform, and you're performing one now knowing there are 4 or 5 tasks waiting for you, right? Like, I experience that in my daily practice. If I'm seeing a patient and I see there I have 2 or 3 patients waiting in the waiting room, I get a little bit anxious. So if I boost my attention, and apparently that's what stimulants do. They can improve your attention as long as it is impaired. If you have a reasonable under the curve attention, it doesn't turn you into a super attentive person above average, you know, because there's a biological limit to that. But let's say you take a low dose of Adderall, and now you can actually, which will be the equivalent of chemical mindfulness. Maybe I shouldn't say that, but again, I'm not recommending it. That just needs to be clear. I'm not recommending stimulants. If anything, try to have a clean practice, but as much as possible, not always. But then, you know, you improve your attention a little bit. Now you're able to focus in one problem at a time. Despite multiple demands, you feel less overwhelmed and you feel less anxious.
Fair. That makes sense. Yeah, fair enough. So how do we fix these things?
One of the proposed solutions for this, it will take into account the following description of the problem. How do we figure what symptoms are a proper description of a given syndrome? Well, we get some folks suffering from GAD, generalized anxiety disorder, and we see how many of them have restlessness, how many have inattention. And then we conclude that most do. Right? But that is sort of a confirmation bias. To get rid of it, we'll have to look into people that don't have a given diagnosis, let's say generalized anxiety disorder, and see how many of them have inattention, how many of them have restlessness. Now we find out that a lot of people who don't meet criteria for generalized anxiety disorder or has no significant suffering stemming from it also may have those symptoms, inattention and restlessness.
Right.
Instead of looking only into what generalizes of, and this is, please follow me here. Instead of looking into what GAD people have, we may have to also start looking into what GAD people don't have. And also we have to look into what people without generalized anxiety disorder don't have or do have. You can cut this also and drop your question.
So it's basically the predictive, positive, and negative values of the symptoms?
Yes, that's exactly. I guess you pay attention. Yeah. That's exactly it.
But do we have enough formal research in that regard? We don't, right?
No. Well, yes and no. So literature is loaded with some information that you could be used as such. Just like, you know, the mining of this kind of information is very painful. You know, phenomenological research, research that shows, you're going to find a research that says, hey, we compared kids with ADHD with community samples. Now you have the community sample. That allows you to have a sense of, okay, I have a bunch of kids referred to a clinic that end up without a diagnosis, but they also had a bunch of symptoms. But, you know, having the symptoms doesn't mean they have the diagnosis. It's not sufficient.
Oh, you're talking about the symptoms base rates, right?
Yeah. They play the same key, and that's a very good source of information. But the mining of it, you know, you got to go through. It's a funny book, you know, has a lot of, it's just like tables, and you see the table and you find a topic that you like, and then you go to the original article to understand how the data was collected to make sure it makes sense. And then you may find, for example, for ADHD, one of the symptoms with best positive predictive power is can't finish board games, or you leave meals halfway,
right,
just because of the restlessness.
Could we develop it a little bit?
I think we, so for the level we go through this thing, for a podcast, it would require some adaptation. You know, we do that a lot for the mentorship program, but the depth of it, the complexity of it, usually requires that the listener can actually stop and say, go back, I don't understand, because the concept of predictive positive and negative value are quite complex, you know, for some people. So I think for everyone. So we could plan for the future, but I wouldn't do it here.
Great. Dr. Nardi, thank you so much for sharing your knowledge with us. I'd like to remind the listeners that we do have the previous episodes uploaded to our website. So if you want to go there and check it out, it's nepmi.org. And Dr. Nardi, as always, a pleasure to have you here. We hope to get together again next week.
Let's do it. Be there.
This podcast was offered by nepmi.org.